The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buppert, retired army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts and a Regular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 064 of Chasing Ghosts in Irregular Warfare podcast. The title of this one is War and Remembrance, Drawing the Wrong Lessons. This is the Memorial Day weekend, which sort of bookends the Veterans Day weekend that occurs in November, and one can draw the same lessons and historical anecdotes and data from both of these events and arrive at some pretty dire and nefarious conclusions. Even though it is framed as a holiday that would have one bow their head slightly and offer up prayers to whatever god or gods you may worship, even if you don't, to offer condolences to those who have fallen in battle in the past. And I've always found it rather fatuous and disingenuous and just a lot of cosplaying, and it's always bothered me. And we're going to examine some of that in this episode on this Memorial Day weekend on which I am recording this. A few housekeeping notes. You will note that I have been gone for 2 weeks from publishing a new podcast on either this, Chasing Ghost, or War Notes. That happens to be because I was very busy with my day job. I was very busy going to the Special Operations Forces Week conference in Tampa. And then I had the very happy circumstance of joining my youngest son to celebrate his graduation from college. So that was great. I had a great time at both events. Of course, with my family, I had an even greater time. You may recall, if you're a regular listener, that back in episode 38, which was Moral Injury, the Invisible Warrior Marks, I talked about that very thing. And I wanted to sort of, for those listeners who may be new to my podcast series and haven't listened to it, I'd like to bring you up to date in a very brief fashion. I wanted to quote from Jonathan Shea in his extraordinary book, Achilles and Vietnam Combat Trauma and the Undoing of Character. Quote, "As beasts are beneath human restraints, gods are above them. It would be foolish and untruthful to deny the appeal of exalted godlike intoxication. We have seen the paradox that these godlike exalted moments often correspond to times when the men who have survived them say they have acted like beasts. Above all, a sense of merely human virtue, a sense of being valued and of valuing anything seems to have fled their lives. However, all of our virtues come from not being gods. Generosity is meaningless to a god who never suffers shortage or want. Courage is meaningless to a god who is immortal and can never suffer permanent injury. The godlike berserk state can destroy the capacity for virtue. Whether the berserker is beneath humanity as an animal, above it as a god, or both, he is cut off from all human community when he is in that state." End of quote. I know that seems a bit arcane, but if you would examine it, and I especially urge you to pick up that book if you get the opportunity, you're interested, Achilles in Vietnam, Combat Trauma and the Undoing of Character. What this is addressing is those things that happen in the combat theater and in combat between humans competing on either side of a given conflict and engaging in that actual conflict in the maiming and killing of other lives, most likely people that they'll never know and didn't know. And what that does to the residual moral fiber of a human being after that happens, that stays with them. I remember, barely, old age is addling me, that when I did that podcast, it hit me hard, and I thought, this moral injury that I possess from things that I have done in the past that I don't always carry with honor or have been able to contort through the forest of memory and form it into something that was laudable or virtuous, because I can't, that sticks with you. There's no cure for this. There's no way for a mental health professional to come to you with moral injury from wartime and say, if you'll take the following drugs, if you'll do the following things on my couch, if you'll do the following exercises, you can take this away from yourself. You can excise it like a disease from your being. No, you can't do that. Another great book is Carl Malante's What It Is Like to Go to War. Quote, or the pilots doing 9-to-5 jobs at computer consoles in Nevada, killing people in Iraq and Afghanistan with drones and commuting to and from their homes like any other commuters. Imagine the psychic split that must ensue from bringing in death and destruction from the sky on a group of terrorists. I'll even put that in air quotes. Young men who have mothers and misplaced idealism that has led them into horrible criminal acts, but nevertheless, young and brave men, and then driving home from a base to dinner with the spouse and kids. Have a nice day at the office, hun. End of quote. Wow, talk about a horrific philosophical bifurcation. That's what that is. So on reflection, I find that more and more moral injury is real. It is something that even the folks at SOCOM are addressing. I suspect that SOCOM is addressing this in a much more substantive fashion than any theater command or combatant command in the United States Armed Services. And I tip my hat to them. Thank you for doing what you do and trying to make some sense of what is a really difficult, if not rather arcane malady that is affecting so many soldiers, especially those who spent some time on the ground in the last quarter century in any of the recent, quote, brushfire wars that America hasn't been involved in. So if you're looking for the happy, happy, joy, joy version of Memorial Day remembrance, I would hit the stop button on this podcast episode right now and go listen to some happy talk about Memorial Day and those who wish to speak to the tremendous virtue, bravery, and exploits of past fighters from wars immemorial, and why this is the day we take our hats off and put our hands over our hearts and declare ourselves ever so thankful to all of these young men, mostly, who we sent overseas, most likely, in order to fight other combatants. Now, mind you, a predicate or preamble to a lot of these wars has been this very curious stream of maritime provocations, starting with the Maine in 1898, with the Spanish-American Wars, and then we fast forward to 1914 to 16 to 17. Remember the Lusitania? Fast forward to 1941 in December, and we find that even though I happen to think that the Japanese had been provoked into doing so, and I'm not taking away the fact that they were the moral and martial agents who did Pearl Harbor, I do think that the administration at the time under FDR had a hand in manipulating the behavior of what the Japanese would do in the Pacific. Again, a maritime provocation. If one looks at the Tonkin Gulf resolution in Vietnam in 64 and 65, same thing. You can fast forward to what's been happening of late in the Red Sea at the hands of Yemen, which doesn't possess a navy to speak of at all, and which the U.S. Navy has proclaimed, I'm paraphrasing, we have been in the most intense naval combat since World War II, apparently forgetting the operation that was conducted in the early 90s. Called Proportion by the U.S. Navy, in which they were involved in that kind of combat. Hat tip to the Fat Electrician, whose YouTube channel I really enjoy, and I strive to be as entertaining as him if I can on occasion. But so from 1898 until this time, there has had to have been provocation in all of these wars of choice. If you've listened to me long enough, You know that I am quite skeptical of the causus belli that are involved to get America into conflict and into all of these wars. And it just so happens that having the fortune and happenstance of being surrounded by oceans, Atlantic and Pacific, respectively, North America and the U.S. right smack dab in the middle, has been gifted since probably 1814-15, when the British finally left the continental United States, with only engaging in wars of choice. Now, some of my listeners, especially the new ones, may say, but Bill, what about 9/11, for instance, in 2001? Was that not a provocation on the part of Al-Qaeda and the rest to get America involved in the Middle East? And I would tell you that, as with all things, there are root causes and proximate causes, and there are second and third order effects to things that have taken place in the past. And as I just mentioned, on predicates and preambles to conflict, 9/11, I suspect, would not have happened if America, and by the way, Churchill, from 1918 to 1922, had designed a Middle East that seemed to have been custom-built for internecine, intrastate, and interstate conflict that would bug, bother, and possess the rest of the world. And then, of course, we see that in the 1980s, Osama bin Laden, the head of Al-Qaeda, was a federal employee, as it were, in Afghanistan, conducting all the good works in Afghanistan to allegedly get the Soviets out so that the Afghanistan people could be the ones who decide what they do with their country instead of interlopers, invaders, and outsiders. And the rest is history, of course. Which brings me to part of today's discussion. If we have these oceans, and if we have the circumstance and happenstance of being in this wonderful country that we are, geographically, if anything, of being separated from all of these ancient conflicts on the other side of the Pacific, on the other side of the Atlantic, insulated from them, not having to trouble ourselves with them, making our own way. And by the way, there is a distinction between being isolationist and non-interventionist. An isolationist seals their borders, much like China did for part of its time, before and after the West started their mischief over there. And non-interventionist is where one says, sort of like the Swiss do on and off, I will export and do commerce with the world, but I will not export violence to the world. And I, as I've told folks again and again, warfare, Murphy is the king of battle. And wars are won by the least incompetent forces. And you will rarely find a leader in history, whether in uniform or not, who says, yeah, I'm going to get into this war, but I don't want it to last for years. It'll be over in 1 or 2 weeks. All of them have that confidence at the onset of the friction festival that they're about to get involved in. Who pays the price? Mostly young men. Who pays the price of those young men being damaged, morally injured, mutilated, maimed, and killed? Their families, their friends, their neighbors, their entire communities. All of this comes back to haunt everybody. The celebration of Memorial Day should not be about the soldiery. It should be a mass wake and reflection on the untold millions of innocents detained, kidnapped, injured, napalmed, firebombed, incinerated, shot, mutilated, tortured, and murdered by the barbaric and naked grasping of the American central government for ever-increasing power and control at home and abroad. What I find interesting is that consistently, Happy Veterans Day, Happy Memorial Day, and thank you for your service. What? I hear this familiar refrain again and again. Every May, every November, I am appalled whenever this unthinking salutation is proffered. Look, I'm a retired career Army officer. And like USMC General Smedley Butler before me, I find these sentiments to be hogwash. And by the way, I know that 99% of people who say this to me are saying it in the most impolitic, polite, and well-intentioned and lovely thoughts possible. And I am not bagging on the folks who do that. I am bagging on a media ecosystem and an education ecosystem that has sort of either driven, indoctrinated, or influenced people in a way in which they would think in that very fashion. Can't do a Rod Serling imitation, but I offer you this. The only service rendered was to the American political power structure in the dishonorable hands of the Democrats or Republicans. The former, despite their protestations of peace, have gotten America involved in World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, fast forward to the 1990s. And then, of course, we start in Haiti, we start in Somalia, and then we find that after the Bushevics, both 1 and 2, get us involved in Afghanistan and Iraq, that Obama comes in, flying the flag of the Democrat Party, and starts new conflicts in Syria, Yemen, and Libya, and the Horn of Africa. So you will find that on this podcast, I am not a member of either party, and I will bag on them equally. Look, all of this started with a shameful expropriation of the Mexican territory from 1846 to 1848, to the War of Northern Aggression from 1860 to 65. The United States went into a hyper-colonial overdrive in 1893 in the Hawaiian Islands and has not stopped since. By the way, there was a short interregnum in 1871 where an amphibious invasion of Korea was attempted, tried, and failed. So they came back home and for the next generation continued the rounding up, slaughter, and genocide of American Aboriginals until that was complete. Coast to coast, even though technically speaking, if we're looking at folks killed by American Aboriginals, that particular fight didn't end until the end of the Apaches as far as their war path in 1924. Now, the entire history of American arms on Earth has been a shameful and expansionist enterprise culminating in the first ever post-World War II attack on American soil in 2001. I'm frankly astonished at the length of time it took for a substantive attack of any kind to be initiated on American soil with the breadth, ferocity, and long-sordid history of American mischief and mayhem abroad after World War II. You know, the sheer number of military expeditions the U.S. has embarked on over time is breathtaking. One fellow notes that there have been 234 military expeditions from 1798 to 1793. I didn't find an update to that, but we all know what happened after the year 2000. Another says that 159 instances of the use of United States Armed Forces abroad from October 45 through December 2006. The list does not include covert actions and numerous instances of U.S. forces stationed abroad since World War II in occupation forces or for participation in mutual security organizations, base agreements, and routine military assistance or training operations. You know, good gods, if I were a Martian who landed on Earth recently and found myself attending government schools to include college and watching television for any additional cultural education or the internet news that is out there, I would not be aware of any of this. The constant drumbeat emanating from the state is the Orwellian chorus about America making the world safe for freedom and liberty and never using force abroad except in self-defense, but the history proves otherwise. But let me take a breath and let me take a knee and offer this to you. The internet now offers you the possibility of grokking within your very specialized, narrow interest, a lot of everything that's been published on anything, if you dig hard enough, or find a community out there, or a hobbyist group that's interested in that. Whether it is the concerns of American wars abroad, or collecting 1950s frozen dinners, you will find that information in niche, in boutique spaces, somewhere on the internet that will also lead you down the road with breadcrumbs to books, which will lead you down the road with breadcrumbs to footnotes in said books to get other books. And then you can get what I have termed, thanks to Mortimer Adler teaching me about it in How to Read a Book, a syntopical comprehension of what's going on, which means that basically you've read 3 to 5 books on the same subject. And if you've paid attention through active intellectual interrogation of said book or books, you will arrive at conclusions that would even put amateur historians like us on par with probably the majority of the professoriate that is laboring away in the historiographical crash sites at various universities. America, next to Rome in the Western world, ranks as one of the world's most aggressive nation states when you examine the evidence. A country sheltered from the tempestuous and constant warring on the European continent by one ocean, and the turbulence in Asia by another ocean, yet it simply cannot mind its own business, nor resist the temptation to maim and murder abroad for expansion of political power and control. Now, whether that's for mercantilist or colonial aspirations, I'll let other people sort that out. But the evidence of the actual instantiations of mass violence abroad, well, there's plenty to be found. One can even see that the brutality practiced by American soldiers abroad is not recent, but a long-standing tradition. We're all familiar with a lot of the really ugly stuff that has come out of Afghanistan, from the Abu Ghraib detention facility, torture and manipulation, and just horrific treatment of prisoners of war, even those who were not given prisoner of war status, and a variety of other things. But what I'd like to do is take you on a trip down memory road, and I want to take you to the Philippines at the turn of the century, the 20th century. Quote, like many of their officers, American troops also showed incredible callousness towards the Philippine civilian population. A man named Clarence Clow described the situation as follows in a letter he wrote to Senator Hoar. The methods employed by American troops against civilians in an effort to find insurgent arms and ammunition include torture, beating, and outright killing. At any time, I am liable to be called upon to go out and blind and gag helpless prisoners, to strike them in the face, to knock them down when so bound, to bear them away from wife and children at their very door, who are shrieking pitifully the while, or kneeling and kissing the hands of our officers, imploring mercies from those from who seem not to know what it is. And then, with a crowd of soldiers, hold our helpless victim's head downward in a tub of water in his own yard, or bind him hand and foot, attaching ropes to head and feet, and then lowering him into the depths of a well of water till life is well nigh choked out, and the bitterness of a death is tasted, and our poor, gasping victims ask us for the poor boon of being finished off in mercy to themselves. All these things have been done at one time or another by our men, generally in cases of trying to obtain information as to the location of arms and ammunition. Nor can it be said that there is a general repulsion on the part of the enlisted men taking part in these doings. I regret to have to say that, on the contrary, the majority of soldiers take a keen delight in them and rush with joy to the making of this latest development of a Roman holiday, end of quote. You will note here that what he's describing is waterboarding, because the waterboarding that you saw taking place during the Afghanistan and Iraq conflicts, when the Office of Legal Counsel in the Bush administration in 2003 issued a legal finding saying, yea and verily, this kind of torture, oh, mind you, enhanced interrogation taking place, it meets with the rule of law in the United States, and we're going to proceed ahead with that. Another soldier, L.F. Adams, with the Washington Regiment, described what he saw after the Battle of Manila on February 4th and 5th, 1899. Quote, in the path of the Washington Regiment and Battery D of the 6th Artillery, there were 1,008 dead black people. That's how they referred to the Filipinos, and a great many wounded. We burned all their houses. I don't know how many men, women, and children the Tennessee boys did kill. They would not take any prisoners. Similarly, Sergeant Howard McFarland of the 43rd Infantry wrote in the Fairfield Journal of Maine, I am now stationed in a small town in charge of 25 men, and I have a territory of 20 miles to patrol. At the best, this is a very rich country, and we want it. My way of getting it would be to put a regiment into a skirmish line and blow every Filipino into Filipino heaven. On Thursday, March 29th, 18 of my company killed 75 Filipino Bolo men and 10 of the Filipino gunners When we find one that is not dead, we have bayonets. These methods were condoned by some back home in the U.S., as exemplified by the statement of a Republican congressman in 1909. He said, quote, "You never hear of any disturbances in northern Luzon, and the secret of its pacification is, in my opinion, the secret of pacification of the archipelago. They never rebel in northern Luzon because there isn't anybody there to rebel. The country was marched over and cleaned in a most resolute manner. The good Lord in heaven only knows the number of Filipinos that were put underground. Our soldiers took no prisoners. They kept no records. They similarly swept the country, and whenever they got hold of a Filipino, they killed him. The women and children were spared and may now be noticed in disproportionate numbers in that part of the island," end of quote. Now, I've spent time in the Philippines, in uniform and out. I love the Philippines, and the Philippines, like Vietnam, I am in awe, and of course this is anecdotal when I say this, I am in awe at not only their inherent forgiveness, but how lovely the people are and how they appear to not have a very extensive tribal or cultural memory of what was done to them by the United States starting in 1898 and continuing throughout the 20th century. After all the color revolutions that have plagued American foreign policy and helped America to get into many of its wars of choice, they started their careers, I would say the three-letter agencies to include the CIA and the now defunct and happily buried in my mind U.S. Agency for International Development, were responsible for color revolutions, and from 1984 to 1986, that was probably the primary testbed for what we see as the current incantation of color revolutions in Manila in the Philippines. Now, if you have the stomach for it, you can go to the primary sources and the secondary source documentation of what happened during the Philippines campaign starting in 1898 during the Spanish-American War. And it is absolutely horrific to behold. And remember that these are testimonies by troops at the time who, not using any kind of presentism, which is the historiographical constraint on not looking backwards with the moral or cultural framework that you have now, and judging people's actions and behaviors on that very thing. At the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, the end of slavery in America was only two generations old. And the attitude towards folks who didn't happen to share the same culture or moral political understandings were viewed with contempt. Look, my podcast, my opinions. The only just war is one fought to defend one's own soil from invasion. There is no other. Every other conflict reeks of statist opportunism and a yen to expand, in my mind, tax jurisdictions and the power to rob others of their wealth and resources. Some may mistake this for a pretense of the left. Not only do the progressives and the collectivists in America have a rich history of cheerleading wars such as World War I and World War II, after all, Democrats were in office when both of those wars were entered into by the United States, but they also wish to employ military-style violence domestically to achieve that government supremacist dream. And I would suggest to you that the other party in America, the Republicans, tend to just go along to get along with these very notions. That, you know, as a matter of fact, the notion that foreign wars and entanglements are wrong still emanates from a sparsely populated philosophical quarter that has no majority presence in the academy or the government media complex. It is a true voice in the wilderness, those of us who are non-interventionist and think that nothing good has come from America's wars of choice. That voice has one signature message in my mind. You cannot thank a veteran for your freedom because they have actively done nothing more than endanger its very existence, because everything an empire does abroad, and America is indeed an empire, it will come home. American military power abroad, and increasingly at home, has made civilians more unsafe than they have ever been. The threat not only emerges from aggrieved victims of American brutality abroad and that would be perception or reality, but a government desperate in bad times to ensure that not $1 of military expenditures is reduced. America is now a national security garrison state. Think about that the next time you take a flight. Veterans don't need gratitude, but a self-realization on their part that the machine they work for was never an engine for liberty, but a device whose single purpose was aggrandizement of American political power at home and abroad. And that political hammer always extinguishes liberty, and never expands it. Gandhi, love him or hate him, he has an interesting quote where he says, "What difference does it make to the dead, the orphans, and the homeless, whether the mad destruction is wrought under the name of totalitarianism or the holy name of liberty and democracy?" I have come to none of these conclusions congratulating myself on my wisdom, because for most of my adult life, while I have been a skeptic, I have thought that, especially when in uniform, doing the very best thing that I could in the circumstances that I was in, most likely I was overseas, when doing so, I made the very best of it and rationalized it in a sense where I could say there's some virtue in this. On reflection, I deceived myself. In the words of one of my colleagues, he said, "My favorite U.S. politician was Aaron Burr, because Aaron Burr challenged Hamilton to a duel and shot him dead. Burr fought the only just American war. So I celebrate Burr on political holidays like this." As an amateur historian, there's something I've discovered, that the farther away an historical example is that I expound upon, the less people have a vested interest in their side bias when it comes to examining it. Hence, I love to examine what happened in the Spanish-American War, especially in the Philippines, to show that this cruelty, depravity, and almost baked-in torture fetishism was in the American military way back when. You will find some extraordinary primary source evidence, for instance, from Secretary Root's record. Let me read you some things by Brigadier General J.F. Bell. And this is from 1901 and 1902, and this was before congressional testimony that had been taken. And these were memorandums that were issued by Bell to his soldiers on how they would behave. I'll take some extracts here. Quote, "Any able-bodied male found by patrols or scouting detachments outside of protected zones without passes will be arrested and confined or shot if he runs away." Here's one from 1901, December 24th, to all station commanders. Quote, "Little should be said. The less said, the better. The making of threats which cannot be carried out should especially be carefully guarded against. Let's acts, not words, convey intentions. The more an officer does and the less he says about what he is going to do, the more apprehensive and anxious will become those who are guilty and who wait for what is next to happen." End of quote. What you find in looking at all of J.F. Bell's stuff is that he is trying to make sure that the record keeping that is supposed to take place as part of the Army culture at the time, the war diaries as they were, are not going to be such that once they are looked at ex post facto by his bosses back in America, both uniformed and politicians, that it will not shed a bad message on what they were actually doing. In other words, the military authorities took whole provinces of people apparently pursuing their ordinary avocations and undertook, by every form of oppression, burning their houses, destroying their food, confining them within certain zones, confiscating their property, imprisoning them, or forcing them to work, to make them active agents on the American side in this war of conquest. As a matter of fact, I think it was General Bell who was the one that said, "Any male in the wild at large who is over the age of 10 is eminently targetable and can be killed at any time simply for walking through the woods, being on a game trail, or just happening to be in front of soldiers who ran across them." This is barbarism. This is barbaric. By the way, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, sure, there was plenty of moral and virtuous soldiery that was conducted. But there was certainly the other side of the coin again, as Peter Boghossian would tell us with side bias. Side bias is that evidentiary law that is the hardest one to defeat. And in this case, when America conducts its wars overseas, because of course we know that for the past 150 years, they have exclusively been extraterritorial from America proper, because these are wars of choice, they are rationalized in a fashion that says, well, we did the right thing at the time, we may have made some mistakes, but to paraphrase Joseph Stalin, you've got to break a few eggs to make an omelet. Secretary Elihu Root was an American lawyer, Republican politician, statesman, who served as the 41st U.S. Secretary of War under President McKinley and Roosevelt, and he was the one who wanted to review all the records of activities in the Philippines at the time during the Spanish-American War. He was in office from 1899 to 1904. I am thankful that Root took the time to quite literally root out a lot of this rot and put it into public record. That's precisely what he did, and it is absolutely horrific. For instance, in Secretary Root's record, there's something called marked severities in Philippine warfare. Some startling conclusions are found once they started fiddling with the numbers. There's a quote from Mr. Herbert Welsh of Philadelphia, an official of the War Department. He says, quote, "The aggregate killed and wounded Filipinos reported by commanding officers is 14,643 and 3,297 wounded. As to the number of Filipinos whose deaths were due to incidents of war sickness, burning of habitations, we have no information. The comparative figures," this is the end of the quote, "but when I looked at this, the comparative figures of killed and wounded, nearly five killed to one wounded, if we take only the official returns, and all of us, especially for those of us who have served in uniform, know that there is both exaggeration and undercounting here, are absolutely convincing. When we examine them in detail and find the returns quoted of many killed and often no wounded, only one conclusion is possible." And remember, this is 1899 to 1904, so the American Civil War is still a recent memory for everybody because it had only concluded 35 years beforehand. So they used that as an example, and in the fiercest battles of the Civil War, the proportion was as follows: at Antietam, where we attacked, killed 2,010, wounded 9,416. At Fredericksburg, where we charged again and again under a withering fire of rifles and cannon, killed 1,180, wounded 9,028. At Gettysburg, where two veteran armies joined in desperate battle, I'm quoting from Root's record here, killed 2,834, wounded 13,709. At Cold Harbor, where the carnage was frightful, killed 1,905, wounded 10,570. In the recent Boer War, the proportion is the same. At Magersfontein, killed 171, wounded 691. In no war where the usages of civilized warfare have been respected has the number of killed approached the number of wounded more nearly than these figures. The rule is generally about five wounded to one killed. What shall we say of a war where the proportions are reversed? How are these figures explained by the officers in command? By the way, a lot of mealy-mouthed responses, but I do find this an extraordinary data outcome of the Philippines, where we do have this reversal of killed versus wounded, and I think that all of us within listening range of my voice can come to a conclusion of just what happened in the Philippines at the time. Again, I use this so that I can get, in this case, a 125-year interregnum, so that those of us who have been subject to the triumphalist narrative of World War I and especially World War II don't find ourselves with evidentiary blinders when it comes to exactly what happened then. Now, as far as the conclusion of the Spanish-American War and what happened in the American forces to improve upon what was actually a very devilish and murderous campaign, did that change during the wars that occurred during the 20th century? I think the jury is still out. If I were to fast forward to the Vietnam War, and I do think that there was some hyperbolic statistics in Kill Everything That Moves by Nick Turse at the American Empire Project. Nonetheless, by reading several books, like the book that I did a episode on when I covered My Lai, you find that this kind of behavior, I'm not going to say that it is regular behavior by the U.S. Armed Forces, but it is certainly there. And in the aggregate, those who permit these kind of things to happen, even if they didn't participate in it themselves, in my mind, they're just as guilty as those who did it. There was a book published in 1926 called The Conquest of the Philippines by the United States, 1898 to 1925, by Marshall P. Lachauco and Moorfield Story, that had what I think is a rather startling paragraph, and I'm going to read that. Now, this is about the death toll of the occupation in the Philippines. And there was a detailed estimate of both civilian and American military dead offered by historian John Gates. And he sums it up in concert with the folks who wrote the book I just cited. Quote, of some 125,000 Americans who fought in the islands at one time or another, almost 4,000 died there. Of the non-Muslim Filipino population, which numbered approximately 6.7 million, at least 34,000 lost their lives as a direct result of the war, and as many as 200,000 may have died as a result of the cholera epidemic at the war's end. The U.S. Army's death rate in the Philippine-American War was the equivalent of a nation having lost over 86,000 people of roughly 2.7 million engaged during the Vietnam War, instead of approximately 58,000 who were lost in that conflict. And by the way, here's John Gates drawing from that. And I told you that that book was published in 1926. John Gates was using that book as the source for the numbers that he came up with. And then I go back, quote, for the Filipinos, a loss of 34,000 lives was equivalent to the United States losing over a million people from a population of roughly 250 million. Or if the cholera deaths are also attributed to the war, the equivalent death toll for the United States would be over 8 million. This war was about death, genocide, conquest by American authorship. The U.S. troops slaughter Filipino civilians out of proportion to the convention of the so-called formal warfare. And that was remarked upon in the Senate investigation of the war's conduct. Quote, the comparative figures of killed and wounded, nearly five killed to one wounded, as I told you earlier, are absolutely convincing. When we examine them in detail and find the returns quoted as many killed and often no wounded, only one conclusion is possible, as I had stated a few minutes ago. I'm ashamed of this, and I find that when I lift the lid from so many of America's campaigns overseas, you discover that this savage streak that is, I wouldn't say that it has World War II Pacific Japanese dimensions in the least, because those are exponentially worse in so many ways, from those living as POWs, those killed, what happens to wounded, those kind of things. But I'm here to tell you is that there are no angels of war here, and that America has never even engaged in that kind of warfare without participating in this. So these committee proceedings adjourned June 28, 1902. For 2 months after this, the legal team presenting evidence for the committee compiled its report. This report was released on August 29, 1902, under the title Secretary Root's Record, Marked Severities in Philippine Warfare, an analysis of the law and facts bearing on the action and utterances of President Roosevelt and Secretary Root. The report was a damning indictment of U.S. policy. I will put this in the show notes. But I wanted to tell you the 13 conclusions that were drawn from the evidence. That, number one, that the destruction of Filipino life during the war has been so frightful that it cannot be explained as a result of ordinary civilized warfare. Number two, that at the very outset of the war, there was strong reason to believe that our troops were ordered by some officers to give no quarter and that no investigation was had because it was reported by Lieutenant Colonel Crowder that the evidence would implicate many others. General Elwell Otis saying that the charge was not very grievous under the circumstances. Number three, that from that time on, as is shown by the reports of killed and wounded and by direct testimony, the practice continued. Number four, that is, War Department has never made any earnest effort to investigate charges of this offense or to stop the practice. Number five, that from the beginning of the war, the practices of burning native towns and villages and laying waste the country has continued. Number six, that the Secretary of War never made any attempt to check or punish this method of war. Number seven, that from a very early day, torture has been employed systematically to obtain information. Number eight, that no one has ever been seriously punished for this, and that since the first officers were reprimanded for hanging up prisoners, no one has been punished at all until Major Glenn, in obedience to an imperative public sentiment, was tried for one of many offenses and received a farcical sentence. Number nine, that the Secretary of War never made any attempt to stop this barbarous practice while the war was in progress. Number 11, that the statements of Mr. Roots, whether as to the origin of the war's progress or the methods by which it has been prosecuted, have been untrue. Number 12, that Mr. Root has shown a desire not to investigate and, on the other hand, to conceal the truth touching the war and to shield the guilty, and by censorship and otherwise, has largely succeeded. That Mr. Root, then, this is number 13, is the real defendant in this case. The responsibility for which has disgraced the American name lies at his door. He is conspicuously the person to be investigated. The records of the War Department should be laid bare, that we may see what orders, what cablegrams, what reports are there, his standard of humanity, his attitude towards witnesses, the position which he has taken, the statements which he has made, all prove that he is the last person to be charged with the duty of investigating charges which approved recoil on him. End of quote. As I said, this will be in the show notes for you to review at your leisure. Those of you who are unfamiliar with the Spanish-American War, I would tell you it may very well be patient zero for the overseas imperial desires and expansion of the American project. And you can find it there. Now, one, as with all historiography, the root causes, the proximate causes, the second and third order effects, the cause and effect can go back even further than that. But I would say that this is the first concrete and substantive starting block where one can examine just what the conduct of American forces in these wars of choice could be. So I think that's pretty grisly. I urge all of my listeners to take a look at this. Again, I wanted to emphasize the reason why I have stepped back over a century for this is to sort of eliminate any kind of residual triumphalist narrative propaganda that has informed so much of why we have a Veterans Day, why we have a Memorial Day, and why it's all about glad-handing and rationalizing wars overseas and then grabbing the hand of a man that you find who may have very well served, air quotes, overseas and thanking him for his service, when in fact his service may have very well not rendered an improvement to your liberty or freedom, but found new and noxious ways to bring the empire home and make your life even more subject to grievous liberty-taking, regulatory overreach, and living in this surveillance panopticon that we find ourselves laboring under every day. As I mentioned, I covered moral injury in general in episode 38, but in episode 46, I also did a review and discussion, My Lai, Vietnam, 1968, and The Descent into Darkness by Howard Jones, which I find to be probably one of the signal best efforts to cover what happened at My Lai. And to remember that when that My Lai massacre occurred, and after I had started investigating what happened in the Philippines, I can't remember the cart or the horse or which came first, it troubled me that I found so many similarities between these incidents that just so happened to be 70 years apart. But nonetheless, the evidence was there that there was a certain normality to the really ill treatment and maiming and killing of civilians. And that, as usual, as we saw with Secretary Root's exploits during the Spanish-American War, and as we found with all the administrations that were overseeing America's unfortunate involvement in the Vietnam conflict, that there was a lot of political and bureaucratic cover for what were odious deeds conducted under the American flag at the time. So I wanted to cover a couple quotes from Nick Turse's book, Kill Anything That Moves. Quote, "To say that the military's top-level cover-ups and Newsweek's partial suppression of its own investigation were effective would be an understatement. There have been more than 30,000 nonfiction books published on the Vietnam War since the conflict began, but only a tiny fraction focus on American atrocities. Of these, nearly all the ones written since 1975 concentrate exclusively on the My Lai massacre or narrowly investigate a particular subject. And while some of the text on atrocities written during the war cast a wider net, they were necessarily anecdotal, fragmentary, and speculative, lacking official documentary evidence and a comprehensive picture of the war's entire duration across the various regions of the country. Only by combining veterans' testimonies, contemporaneous press coverage, Vietnamese eyewitness accounts, long classified official studies, and the military's own formal investigations into the many hundreds of atrocity cases that it knew about, can one begin to grasp what the Vietnam War really entailed?" End of quote. That is from Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, which has been criticized for being rather politically tempered to the left and oriented in that fashion and not as hard on their opposite numbers in the communist forces of Vietnam. Be that as it may, though, I'm only concerned in this case about what the documentation is about American atrocities then. One can go back to World War II and find many stories of this. I urge everyone, if they get the opportunity, to look into what happened in the post-war occupation in the four European sectors of Europe when it was divided after the war, especially in Germany. And you will come to some startling conclusions that are not very complimentary of what the United States has painted itself as worldwide after 1945. So if I come to any point from all of this, of course I want you to examine all the evidence on your own. But I want you to ask this on a consistent basis as you're reading primary and secondary source documentation. You will all know that you have to be cautious about a bureaucracy's willingness, if not institutional incentives, to hide things that show them in a bad light and to see it that way. But in the broader context, what you have to examine is that when a country goes to war, especially wars of choice, as America has so often, it appears that when it does, all the tethers, leashes, and handcuffs, if you don't mind me using that kind of illustrative example of that warfare that the Hague and Geneva Conventions and the international laws of land warfare, which are used to distinguish large armies from wholesale operations by serial killers for a reason, you will find that America doesn't always come out linen white in the end. I would ask that you examine that in the next time on this Memorial Day that is going to be contemporaneous to this podcast, or the bookend of the Veterans Day in November, that the next time someone says, "Thank you for your service," I realize that they're trying to be kind and well-mannered, but in the end, it doesn't serve the purpose it should, which is let's find a way to never do it again, unless it is a just war fought on our own soil to defend ourselves from invaders. So this is Bill, and I have some exciting news coming up that I can't reveal yet. I'm waiting to be permitted to say so as far as other ventures and avocations I will be taking part in. And I wanted to thank you for your listenership and solicitude. If you wish to get in touch with me, you can get in touch with me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. In the show notes, you will find the path to my Substack, where I have a comments function on every one of these podcasts. And give me some gentlemanly feedback on episodes you'd like to see in the future, disagreements that we may have, whatever the case may be. Again, I am thankful for you taking the time to listen to this, and this is Bill out.